comfortably. I'll say that again. Looks like everybody's seated comfortably. And just want to say a word of appreciation to you for being here. We recognize that it's not only an investment of time, but with gas prices being what they are, it's a fairly significant investment in terms of money to be here. So thank you. It says a lot about your character. This morning we're going to be talking about godly conduct, proper youthful conduct that we can develop as Christians. You can develop proper youthful conduct. I, however, just going to have to settle for proper godly conduct. As we do, let's think about how it can affect our influence on others. What we're going to do is, first we're going to take a look at some of the background. We're going to invest a little bit of our time this morning, a fair chunk really, thinking about the background that Timothy was facing at the church in Ephesus as he began to do the work. His obstacles and the goals, those charges that have been mentioned that Paul had given him, those were his responsibilities. And those were his goals by default. Those were the things that he would want to get done. But he had some tremendous obstacles that he would face. And when you have an understanding of the background, it gives you a better appreciation for what he was facing. It gives you a better appreciation for just how difficult it was for this young man. Timothy is a young man. He's described that way consistently through this period. We don't know his precise age, but he was certainly young. And he was certainly facing additional challenges because of that youth. And we're going to see how him being a godly character, the developing that godly character to serve God faithfully, that was going to be a tremendous ally for him in trying to influence the brethren for good. And what we're going to do after we look at that background and a few other points, one illustration, if you happen to see these, please do not panic. They do not mean what you might think they mean. We will get to them, though. David pleaded with me, why don't you just put that on a slide? But it was too late, so I went ahead and did it this way. What we're going to see as we look at the example that Paul wanted him to become, six specific things that we should add to our conduct. Very practical, very low level, and we're not really going to spend enough time on any one of them. We're going to hit them pretty quickly, but we're going to look at these six specific things that I think get overlooked, some of them particularly get overlooked in developing a godly character. And then the lesson will be yours. From last night, Eric's lesson, he made that point, and Paul, hold the reading because I want to ask the question first. What were those three things that are mentioned there in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5? The first one, let's try to do them in order. The first one, in just one word, let's do just the one word. Love. That was and remember, what was it that he's elaborating on there? He says, the purpose of the what? The purpose of the commandment is love from a pure conscience and from sincere faith. That's right, the clear conscience and the sincere faith. And as we look at the commandments that we're seeing this morning, that's still true. The purpose of these charges, of these commandments that Paul has directed to the young evangelist Timothy, were in order to build him up, to have the love that he ought to have for the brethren, for the truth, and that he might develop that pure conscience, that sincere faith that he needed. It's crucial because, see, that hits at the very motivation, the very intent in the thoughts of our heart. Why do we do what we do? Well, it's not just to go through the motions. It is to please God. Without faith, we can't please God. Can we please God without love? No, we're just going through the motion. Paul, 1 Corinthians 13 says, if I don't have love, I'm just making a bunch of noise. So certainly those things are crucial. Let's not forget them as we move on. Now I've asked David if he would to read the text that we're looking at this morning. I'm so sorry, I skipped you, Paul. Let's read it. Let's get that before us. Let's keep that before us as we move forward. David, go ahead and read for us 1 Timothy 4:11 through 16. Okay, that's the text we're looking at. Now, this morning, we're going to mainly look at verses 12, 13, 15, and 16. And we're going to introduce some of these godly conduct characteristics from other passages as well. But these are the ones we're going to look at for the most part. Before we do, I mentioned that we were going to look at the background. You're familiar with the background. Eric touched on it a pretty good bit last night. But I want you to take some special effort this morning as we go through this. Try to put yourself in Timothy's position. And just kind of grasp the enormity of the challenges that he was facing, the importance of the task that lay before him. Very important. Ephesus was a very wealthy, it was a very important city in the ancient world. It was a city of about 250,000, quarter of a million. It was very diverse in its population. There were many from Rome. There were Greeks who were there. Of course, as there were in most all of the ancient cities in that area, there was a large contingent of Jews there. And there would be people from Galatia and Phrygia, of course, there in Asia Minor. And people passing through, it was a center for commerce. And so for that reason, it was a city that had a great deal of wealth and was really second only to Rome in terms of its significance in terms of the Roman Empire. It was very influential. Paul had spent 3 years there working with these brethren. Now you can see the brethren that he's working with, they are from the people I just mentioned. Some of these were Jews, had been and were by nationality Jews, but now they're Christians. Some of them were Greeks, and that brought the Greek philosophies and that background. Then you had the Romans with their brand of paganism. And all of the different ideas that people would have bring. So they brought a lot of baggage into the church that needed to be dealt with. Paul had invested a tremendous amount of time and effort working with these brethren. Look over at Acts chapter 20 for just a second here. And we'll kind of read about some of his efforts or the nature of it. Now, you'll remember in Acts 20, where is Paul? Well, I won't be that hard on you. Who is he talking to? Exactly. The elders in the church in Ephesus. Guess what? That's where Timothy's going to be working. That's where he's working as Paul writes to him. So let's see some of the background of what Paul had done. He says verses 18 through 20. And when they had come to him, that is the elders, you know, he said, from the first day that I came to Asia, in what manner I always lived among you, serving the Lord with all humility, with many tears, trials, which happened to me by the plotting of the Jews, how I kept back nothing that was helpful, but proclaimed it to you and taught publicly from house to house. Verse 27, I have not shunned to declare to you the whole counsel of God. Paul had labored among these brethren. And so when you think about that, Paul really invested more time here than virtually any other place that we see. He understood its importance. He understood its strategic importance. And he had a sincere love, I should say, for these brethren. He loved them. He had worked with them. Many of them had been converted by him. So when he entrusts Timothy with this charge, this responsibility to work with these brethren, that meant something to Paul. That was a tremendous responsibility that he was giving him. So let's look at Timothy's goals as he goes through these responsibilities. First of all, 1 Timothy 4 and verse 6. And Garrett Horn, would you read that for us, sir? All right. So what was it that Timothy needed to do. He needed to strengthen the brethren. Paul had been with these brethren and had strengthened them. And we already know that they're going to face some tremendous challenges. And so as Timothy is there, it falls to him to strengthen the brethren. And the good news is he doesn't have to make up what he's going to teach them. Notice what it says here. Nourished, that is, Timothy, would be nourished in the words of faith and of the good doctrine which you have carefully followed. So Timothy already knew the gospel. He had obeyed it. He had taught it. And more importantly, he was now living and teaching it. So that's good. That was a challenge, certainly, for him to strengthen the brethren. But he knew what it was he was to teach. He wasn't to make new things up. He wasn't to try to innovate anything that had not been handed to him, but simply to be firm and consistent in bringing the truth that had been delivered to him, which he had followed. And what does it say here that he would be if he did that? Verse 6. What does it say he would be if he did, if being nourished in this way, what would he become? Exactly. That's exactly right. He would become a good minister of Jesus Christ. Now, again, I'm asking you to think about yourself in Timothy's shoes. What, when you heard Paul say that to you, you can be a good minister of Jesus Christ, nourished in the words of faith. Is that not, that was a, I would think that would be a tremendous encouragement to Timothy to know you can do it. And you know what? So can you. You can do it. You can be faithful. You can develop that godly conduct that will help you to have tremendous influence on the people in this world that you know and are come into contact with. You can do that. Don't doubt that. Embrace that and rejoice in it. That doesn't mean it'll come without conflict, but certainly you can do it. One of the things he was instructed to do is back in chapter 1, verses 3 through 4. Andrew, if you would read verses 3 through 4 for us. Okay, so as Timothy begins his work there, continues his work there, one of the challenges he's going to have is to defend against false doctrine. Well, where was this false doctrine coming from? We've already alluded to some significant sources, the philosophical background of the Greeks, the pagan background of them, as well as the Romans, and of course the Jews. Now the Jews, and this would be true to some extent with the Greeks and the Romans as well, but in particular, the Jews had built a structure of stories and rules and traditions that were on top of the law that had been delivered to them, the simple, pure law of God that they had received. They had all of these rabbinical teachings. And these things had become a muddled mess, really. And they debated them endlessly. It would just wear you out, the minutia to which they would debate these things. Well, Paul is saying to him, don't you get tangled up in that, because what does he say? It doesn't help anybody. It's not the gospel. It doesn't help people understand the gospel. All it's going to do is create what? Starts with a D. Division. It's going to start, the word I had in mind is related, but disputes, discord. Right. I did a lot of D's there. Should have made a slide on that, actually. So, but that would be what he would be facing. And it would be so easy as a sincere young person for him to get tangled up in all that and try to sort it out. Because, after all, Timothy had been instructed in the pure gospel. And he was led by the Holy Spirit through the laying on of the apostles' hands. He had the gift of the Holy Spirit in a miraculous way. And yet, he was told, don't even get tangled up in it. The wisdom of men has infiltrated that to the point that it really, you can't untangle it. And it's not worth it. It's just going to create distraction and disputes and division and discord. So that was certainly a challenge. And then to defend against false doctrine, not only were those who were bringing this baggage in, maybe under the guise that it was, or thought even, that it was helpful, instructive things that could add to the gospel. But there were people then, as there are today, who were concertedly working against the gospel. Paul had set up this church. He had converted these Christians. He had, I say, set it up. He had founded it in the sense that he converted many of those Christians and worked with them to build them up in the faith. And there were people who just didn't like that. And it's hard to imagine that this is still true today. But it is true that there are people with a background in the Lord's church who seem to dislike it. They seem to want to undermine it. And we are naive if we don't believe that even today there are people who are working. I've become aware of some people this very week that are, not, they didn't start this week, I became aware of it this week, but they are endeavoring to undermine the purity of the gospel, especially the way in which we derive authority from the Scriptures. It highlights the need, as Eric emphasized so well last night, I think, you've got to know what you believe, you've got to know why you believe it. It's imperative. It's not good enough just to have an answer that surface. We need to be a little bit deeper than that. We need to be a lot deeper. Timothy certainly had that as a challenge, that as these people, Judaizing teachers in particular, would come in and they would try to draw people, not back to the traditions, but back to the law itself, circumcision, sacrifices that were present under the law. I didn't mention this, but at any point in time, please, if you have a comment, just flag me. Or if you have a question, flag me. It's really just meant to be a class-type environment. So, yeah, I know it's kind of awkward that it's so big, but... So that was a challenge. And then there was just the he's trying to set the example of a godly conduct. And really, this is the key, isn't it? How would this young man, how would he be an influence, you know, among these people? What if he preached the gospel in its purity? What if he stood up against false teaching and did so emphatically? But then when it came to where the rubber meets the road, where he was to live that example before them, he failed. What do you think would happen to his influence among them? It would evaporate. It would disappear because they would see it as false. And indeed, from his perspective, it would be. So that was certainly a challenge, a goal and a challenge, a charge. And, as if we haven't mentioned enough obstacles, there was this one. He had to fill Paul's shoes. Paul, again, we saw how he labored among them. They loved him. They respected him. Back over in Acts chapter 20, whenever he was leaving them, they thought for the last time, they fell on his neck and they wept freely because they thought they wouldn't see him again. They loved him. Paul, we learned, while he was there, he worked with his own hands. He made tents. He was diligent in not only preaching the gospel, but he was diligent in everything that he did. And these brethren loved Paul, and he loved them. It was clear. Well, you can see that in the letter to the Ephesians, how much he loved these brethren. So now he's handing that off to Timothy. Timothy would have a different background. They weren't unfamiliar with him. That would be unfair. But they weren't the aged, the mature apostle, he wasn't, the aged, mature apostle of Jesus Christ that Paul was. And they knew that. They knew that. Certainly, though, he was like-minded with Paul. Paul says so. And it's a bit unfair in some ways, but his youth would play against him. I mean, he was young, and people don't always respect godly wisdom even when it comes from the young, because, see, as we age, we kind of weigh things based on our experiences. And when you start getting older, you collect more experiences, you can work the edge off of things. You develop a deeper understanding. For all of your intensity and zeal, sometimes you don't have that experience. You can't create experience out of thin air. It just happens. But I will say this on your behalf. Sometimes our experiences can be prejudicial. In other words, we think we've seen the movie before, and we misjudge. Sometimes your youth gives you a clarity in looking at the truth and discerning it, that sometimes we can get muddled. We can be muddled by our own experiences. So unfortunate as it is, as Timothy was working with these brethren to try to not allow these fables, this background of philosophy and all these things to creep in that these people might think was helpful, they would look at his youth as a stumbling block. They would say, well, what do you know? You're just a young man. You don't know. And yet Timothy could and would, and Paul expected him to be successful in that. And as we've mentioned, and we won't labor the point, there were those who were working to destroy the truth. The society there, immersed in pagan influences. The Temple of Diana was there. It was the largest structure in the world at the time. It was the center of just some serious debauchery. It was just a cesspool of iniquity. There, in its proximity to the city, it would be a tremendous influence on the inhabitants, not only in the way they lived, but in the way they spoke, in the way they thought, and that would present problems to the church. In the purity of the brethren as they went about their daily lives, they would need to be vigilant in standing against that. Well, Timothy, you know, you probably have seen this happen where maybe you're not among brethren, and people will, your peers, and I mean this in the sense of your age peers, when you are with them out in the world, you probably look at them sometimes and think, what are they thinking? Where are they coming from? Well, sometimes you get lumped in with them, don't you? People may look at you and think you're like them, but you're not. Timothy might have that same problem as an obstacle, that people would look at him and think of the other young people they knew and assume that he had similar interests, motives, and behavior patterns. He would have to show them through godly conduct that he was not that kind of person and that he was different. Your challenges are not that radically different than what Timothy was facing. Do you live in essentially a pagan, wicked society? You do. I mean, we all do. And the challenges are just as real as what Timothy was facing. They're just as severe. Do you have to be wary of false teaching? Doesn't matter where you are, the answer to that question is yes. You've got that same challenge. Are you young? You're young. Sometimes you won't get the respect that your view should have, even though it's biblically based, because of your youth. Don't let that discourage you. It didn't, I think, discourage Timothy. He was successful, I believe, in the work that he was given to do. All right. Let no one despise your youth. This is from verse 12 in our text. When it says, let no one despise your youth, how do you see that? To somebody, give me an idea what you think is there. And I'm not trying to shoot you down or anything. I'm just wanting to get your idea. How do you see yourself letting no one despise your youth? How do you do that? That was exceptionally well said. That's exactly right. The idea here isn't that, okay, well, you're going to, you can't disrespect me. That's where you're demanding that respect. That's not it. What you said is perfectly correct. It was the idea that you don't give them an occasion, don't give them a reason to legitimately despise your youth. Because they don't have any right to despise your youth if you're doing what? if you're walking godly in Christ. If you have pure motives and pure behavior, they don't have the right to despise your youth. So Paul is telling Timothy, in the midst of all this muddle, all these challenges, don't let anybody despise your youth, because you aren't behaving in a way that would cause yourself to be despicable. You live faithfully. All right? Very good. Respect is something that must be earned. And it does indeed take lots of time. It takes a tremendous amount of effort. It takes a tremendous amount of consistency. And that may be the hardest challenge of all. When we're motivated and we're focused, it's a lot easier to live and to project and to have in your heart godly behavior, isn't it? There are times when we're not paying attention, times when we're not focused. And that's when we slip. That can do a tremendous amount of damage. People see that. It creates a lot of collateral damage. So Timothy would have to be consistent in doing that. It would take a lot of time and effort. Certainly we have to do the same. And I made this mention earlier about sometimes you don't receive the due respect because of the things we mentioned. But please understand, godly older Christians, we are pulling for you. We are praying for you. We want to help. We don't know. I mean, it was bad when I was growing up. I think it's worse now. I think the things that you're facing are worse than the things that I faced. I think about a song that says, "The world," I've thought about this a lot lately, "the world, though dark, grows darker still as each man turns to his own will. And love for God is scarcely found, while love for man and self abounds." Love for self and man abounds. That's what you're facing. And we empathize to the extent that we can. And we certainly sympathize. You can do it. You can live godly in Christ. You will suffer for it, but you can do it. And we are here to help and pray for you. And please understand, we are pulling for you. We do want your feedback. Well, as we go, now we're going to transition again, briefly hit these six points of conduct that I want to emphasize. Again, somewhat overlooked, some of them are. I want to make this point. Focus on what you can change. Not necessarily looking for a show of hands, but do you ever feel that there's a lot of stuff outside your control? And do you ever feel like you wish you had more control over your life? I think we all feel that way sometimes. Well, there's a fellow by the name of Stephen Covey in his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. He had an illustration that I think is just so pertinent to this discussion. And what he's encouraging you to do, me to do, same thing Paul's encouraging Timothy to do, is to focus on the things that we can change. And that's why I've got these, actually. This circle here, I want you to pretend that it represents the things that are concerning to you. This is your circle of concern, he called it. And in here is all the things that concern you. It could be who you're going to date, who you're going to marry, where you're going to live, where you're going to go to college, the cost of college tuition. It could be peace in the Middle East. It could be, anything that concerns you. Lots and lots of things fit in here. Certainly, a concern for the work of God. A concern for your ability to influence your peers for good could fit in here. Now, this little circle here can represent your circle of influence. Okay? What's in here is smaller because we've already said there are things in the larger circle we don't control. I don't control gas prices. I don't control the cost of tuition. You don't control the cost of tuition, where you're going to go to school or where you're going to school. So there are some things that we readily admit that we are concerned about, but that we don't control them. So what's the point here? Focus here instead. Don't focus on the things that you cannot control. For example, and this is just a simple example, but if you're concerned about the cost of tuition at your local college, and you really can't do anything about it, you're not going to write them and they're going to lower the cost of tuition. But you're in high school, and you can study harder. What could you get that would defray that cost? Yeah, you can get a scholarship. Maybe even if you're really good, like some here, can just eliminate that cost altogether. So guess what happens when you focus on what you can do, your circle of influence? Your circle of influence grows to consume more of your circle of concern. Now, that's particularly, especially true when it comes to godly conduct. As we look at these are things we control that affect the things we're concerned about. The more we focus on what we do control and not get so overwhelmed with the things we don't, the more proactive we can be, the more useful to God we can be, because we're changing who we are, making ourselves more fit, more mature in the work of the Lord, so our circle of influence grows. I think that's a good example of the importance of focusing on what we can change. All right, we're going to look at proper speech. Now, in verse 12, Paul mentions this already. He says, "Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word." Look over at Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29. Garrett, if you would read that for us, sir. Do you think corrupt speech was a problem in Ephesus? I think it was. We mentioned it's here. It's also found in chapter 5, he says in chapter 5, verse 3, "But fornication and uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks." We see Paul mentioning it here in 1 Timothy chapter 4. We see him mention it when he wrote to the Ephesians. We've already discussed what the background was there. What do you think the common language was like on the streets, influenced as it was by these pagan influences? It'd be pretty bad. And I know for a fact that you guys are just inundated with foul language. And it's not just the obviously foul language that corrupts our speech, is it? Profanity. Somebody give me a working definition of what profanity is. I think this is essential. I'll give you a hint to get you started off. It is to take something special, something holy in the context of God's Word and who He is, and do what with it? Make it common. And we see that is, people do that with people who wouldn't even think that it's profane or corrupt speech. Do that with alacrity. They do that without the least amount of effort. And does that put a tremendous amount of pressure on us to use those terms, those expressions, those acronyms, when we're texting or what have you, and I won't even use the acronym, but when people these days are expressing alarm, people who have no thought of their position before God invoke His name without the slightest consideration. And that puts a lot of pressure on you to keep your speech pure, to keep it from getting corrupted by those influences. In Ephesus, Timothy would need to do the same thing. What if there is Timothy and he's doing the work? He's doing it. He's defending against false teachers. He's teaching the pure gospel, but then he's out and he's using language that is questionable. Just questionable. What does that say about Timothy? Does he really take this seriously? When we speak of things that are holy, that are good things, that are important things in the Lord's work, the church, the elders, the Bible, the Spirit, Jesus, God Himself, when we speak about those things, we should always be guarding our attitude and our tongue. There was a radio commercial some years ago that said, "People judge you by the words you use." It's true. It's not always the best guide, but it is one of the quickest guides to see what the character of an individual is like. Because where do our words proceed from? What does Jesus say about the words? Where do they come from? That's right. They come from within us, in our heart, our mind, our thoughts, our motives. Our words can be disguised sometimes, but if our heart is impure, then we're not going to have words that are consistently pure. We might be able to pull it off sometimes, but we're not going to be consistent, are we? Proper speech is something we can change. We can focus on it. I will tell you, when I became a Christian, I was not raised with a good Bible understanding. Eric and I have a pretty similar background in many ways. Wasn't taught the Scriptures from youth. You guys have a tremendous advantage. Doesn't it inoculate you against everything? It can't motivate you to be sincere unless you take it seriously and study. But I didn't have that. And one of the habits I had after I became a Christian was I had a lot of euphemisms. And it took years to drive those out of my vocabulary because what we say so often, it just flows right out of our mouth. It's repetition. But it had been developed with a careless attitude. And that's really the point, is we can't be careless. We have to be careful. And that's what Paul is encouraging Timothy to be. With your speech, you can destroy the work that you're doing. You're being persecuted for this work. Do you really want to throw it away with just a careless word? Now, this is something that you may think, that's kind of a boring subject. It's not a very important subject. But I'm convinced more and more and more that pride is a destroyer like no other. It is prolific in our society. People, we live in a proud society, and pride finds its way into our hearts. It is elusive. It can hide and manifest itself in ways that you just don't think it can sneak up on. I used to think I didn't have an ego. Seriously. When I was, I guess, in my late 20s, I thought, I don't think I have. I don't think I'm very egotistical. Then I stopped. And I thought, okay, well, why do I do that? You know what the answer more often than not was? Pride. It is so deceitful. It's so sneaky that it motivates us so many times when we don't even think about it. John, if you would, read for us James chapter 4, verse 6. Do you think God is alone in resisting the proud? Do you resist the proud? I think I do. Our natural inclination when we see someone who's arrogant, somebody who is prideful, whenever they present themselves, they are very self-important. They are very dismissive of what other people think and feel and believe. And you know what we tend to do? We tend to dismiss what they say and think and believe because they're motivated by pride. And can you see, is pride easily detectable? Most of the time it is in others. It's kind of hard to see in ourselves. It's deceitful that way. But boy, we bristle when we see it in other people, don't we? And that's true for God as well. He resists the proud. Why? Because they're resisting Him. The proud exalt themselves against God. The proud exalt themselves against everybody because they're self-centered. Develop humility. Again, it's just like those euphemisms that I had. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes years to drive that out of your thought pattern. And I don't think, I say that, but I'd be careful. I have not succeeded. I'm still trying. And I hope you will too, because there's so many problems that it produces. Pride in the church destroys. It is a destroyer like none other. Because what are we supposed to be with one another? Easily entreated? That is, you can come tell me, hey, Greg, you said something today. I really don't think you were right on. Well, what if I've got a little bit of pride? I thought I did a fine job. Well, what do I become? Defensive. Then what do we have? Conflict. I'm convinced many, if not most, of the conflicts that exist in life, in work, here in our worship, those conflicts are born of pride. So please, please, when you contemplate godly conduct, add to your list of things you want to develop humility. And here's another one, gratitude. It is so rare in our society. And I'm going to, please don't take this the wrong way, but this problem is particularly extant among the young. It's particularly present in your generation, and I think I know why, and this is just my fault. Please don't take this the wrong way, but so often your peers, and maybe this applies to you, maybe it doesn't, have had things given. They've been supported. They've been provided for so consistently that you don't see the value. It's easy for us to lose a sense of the value of what is being done for us. And that is the essence of gratitude. David, if you would read 1 Thessalonians 5:18 for us. Hey, I don't think I'm being violent with the Scripture here when I say in everything give thanks. Clearly, I think in view here is you give thanks whether things are good, you give thanks to God whether things are bad. Okay, that's in view. But I don't know that it has to be limited to that. God would certainly have in view there that we are to be grateful for things given to us other than the things that God has provided, things that people provide to us. When someone honors you by showing you some respect, by showing you some kindness, by serving you in some way, do you know the beauty of gratitude is, though you enjoy that thing, if you don't express gratitude, you're cheating yourself from the full enjoyment. Because when you sincerely say thank you, when you maybe write a note that says thank you, and take the time to allow your mind to contemplate what has been done for you, you appreciate it more. Cultivate an attitude of gratitude. And you know what will happen? If you just do these two things, if you do humility and gratitude, I guarantee you, your circle of influence will grow. People will notice that you have added those godly characteristics. It's not easy. Gratitude is certainly much easier to cultivate than humility, in my mind. It certainly has been for me. Gratitude is something that once you begin to cultivate it, it comes easy. And it's not fake. I'm not suggesting you just say thank you, but you don't think about it. Sincere gratitude. That's what you really want to cultivate. Develop a helpful attitude. These are pretty simple, aren't they? Now we're talking about being thankful, being grateful. Develop a helpful attitude. Andrew, would you read, or I'm sorry, Heath, why don't you read Galatians 6:10 for us? And Garrett, if you would read Philippians 2:4. We're getting close to the end here, so hang in there. We'll have a break in just a moment. All right, so two things that jump out at me when I look at these passages is it's almost a proactive looking for, seeking, thinking about, paying attention, scanning for an opportunity to be helpful. You're looking out not only for your own interests, but also for the interests of others. See, and this maybe goes a little bit with pride. When we turn introspective, we don't see the needs of other people. And we do them and ourselves a great disservice when we don't do that. When I know there's some people here who've done an awful lot for others lately. People sitting among you. And I suspect all of you do this. I'm not going to name names for fear of embarrassing them, but I've seen it with my own eyes, and it is a beautiful thing. When people stop and think about what someone else needs, and then plan, not just willy-nilly, but plan to go meet that need and help. A lot of hard work done. A lot of sweat. A lot of strained muscles. It was good. We can do that. It takes getting outside of ourselves for a moment and thinking about what the other people need. And if you do this, again, this is another one of those that seems so simple, but what do you think it does for your circle of influence? It's going to grow when you try to help other people. They're going to notice. Stand for the truth. We have elaborated on this already. I won't go much further, but Paul expected Timothy to stand for the truth in the face of all these difficulties. Well, let's do read Ephesians 4, 14 and 15. And Garrett, I'm going to ask you to read it again. Okay, two things actually being emphasized here. One, that standing, not being blown about, but being steadfast. The other one being growing in truth and in love. Stand for the truth. You are young, but you can see, understand, and stand for what you know. You can develop a solid knowledge of why you believe what you do and how to defend it. Now, and I'm not suggesting, I understand the pressure that comes with being ready to give an answer to anyone that asks a reason for the hope that's within us. That's a very real charge to us, isn't it? And it is a charge to us. But we don't have to have every answer perfect. We just need to try to increase our knowledge as we go along and not give up. Just because it's daunting, and it is, do not be deceived, it is daunting. Embark on the journey. You can do it. And grow in maturity. Titus chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. David, if you would read that for us. And I'm going to read Titus 2, 6 through 8 here. Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded in all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech, there it is again, that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say to you. Who is this being written to? That's the first part of the verse. Young men. That's a pretty tall order, isn't it? What is it saying? It's saying be mature, be strong. This is equally true of young women. You be sober-minded. You show yourself a pattern of good works. In doctrine, integrity, showing that integrity. Reverence in our speech and in our behavior. Sound speech. I missed incorruptibility. Sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. That doesn't mean that life's not fun. It is, you know, Ecclesiastes 11:9 makes it clear. Rejoice in your youth. Yes, you have fun. Enjoy life. That's right and good and proper. Remember that you will give an account. You can do both. They're not mutually exclusive, to enjoy life and to be have a light heart and to enjoy. In fact, you can enjoy it all the more when you're exercising yourself to godly conduct, because you're solid. You're avoiding the pitfalls of life while you're enjoying the benefits. Ask anybody in their 20s or 30s who have made some pretty serious mistakes if frivolity produced the happiness they thought it would. Then talk to someone, and I'm thinking about some who are present here too, that have given themselves to God. How much joy has their life had in it? Tremendous amount. The solidity that comes from that maturity is a great blessing. You can have that. Well, just be aware that these, and we'll just read these last verses. Mr. Meadows, I'm going to ask you to read 1 Timothy 4. We'll just read verses 15 and 16 here in just a moment. But as we look at these, notice that you need God's strength in order to do this. So often we try to run on our own reserves and we can't. Go ahead and read this for us, sir. All right, we're out of time, so I'm just going to summarize right here, and we'll be done. Look at what he's telling them to do. Meditate, make it part of your thought pattern. What? The things that he's been taught, the things that have been delivered to him, the things that he knew about the gospel. Give yourself entirely to them. Devote yourself to them. Notice, too, what did we say? Your progress will be evident to all. What does that sound like? Sounds like your circle of influence is going to grow, doesn't it? If you devote yourself to them, give attention to reading, to doctrine, to the purity that you're to have, you meditate on them, give yourself entirely to them, people will notice, and you will have an influence for good by developing godly conduct, just like Timothy did. Any thoughts or questions? All right, well, thank you very much. Hope to get to see you next year.